أحلى لحظات مع الأوائل.
Good afternoon. My name is Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 37th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is Ali Abdulatif Amida. Ali was born in Wadan, Libya, into a family of seven children, two girls and five boys. His family later moved south to the city of Sabah, where his father was a school teacher, and he and his family lived a full and active middle-class life. Welcome to New Mainers Speak, Ali.
Thank you, Kate. It's wonderful to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I wonder what you could share with us about your upbringing that would help us have a picture of what life was like in the town of Sabah, where you lived from the ages of 6 to 17.
It was a wonderful childhood, even though the family at that time was not as wealthy or well-to-do. Sabha was an emerging small city in the southern part of Libya. In Sabha, there was electricity, running water, movie theater, the only movie theater in the whole southern region of Libya. I studied elementary school, and I went to middle school and high school in Sabha. In Sabha also, I experienced wonderful, normal childhood, like being a Boy Scout, being in the marching band of my middle school and high school.
Playing trumpet.
Yes, yeah. Playing trumpet. And I also was active in the my school activities, in competition and sports and other things. So all in all, it was, I thought, was a very, very happy childhood. And also, Sabha had an incredible opportunities for one a kid like me that time and my generation, where there were five or four major libraries in the middle of the desert, including an American Cultural Center, so where I read most of the American literature and history.
In English?
In Arabic.
In Arabic.
In Arabic. It was translated into Arabic. And also there was a UNESCO UN library in Sabha as well. So this is so unusual, because people, when they think of the desert and Libya at that time, as a really a third world country, there was no opportunities, only a few kids could make it. And on the contrary, I think when I reflect about that period in Libya in the 60s, it was a tremendous and a very fulfilling childhood.
I have to just make a little comment about the Boy Scouts. Honestly, I didn't know Boy Scouts existed outside of America. Boy Scouts of America. It didn't occur to me that there are Boy Scouts of Libya.
Well, it's an international organization, Kate, and it was founded by an Englishman who served in South Africa, Paddy Powell, a man by the name of Paddy Powell, and he made it an international organization. So there are Boy Scouts all over the globe, and even in a small town in southern Libya. I loved it because, you know, you go, you learn interesting things, you make friends with other kids, and also they teach you skills like how to be self-reliant, how to camp, how to plan things, how, and also being just silly, a boy with other boys. And it gave me the opportunity to camp every summer in northern Libya, in Tripoli and Benghazi. And also I represented Libyan Boy Scouts in Tunisia, Algeria and Morocco during my middle school and high school years. So it really gave me tremendous opportunities. And out of it, I made tremendous friendship until this day. I mean, when I meet with some of the old buddies we talk and we exchange ideas and stories, and we laugh about how silly and how sometimes stupid we were at that time.
In your Boy Scout days. I love it. What a cool way to get to know the region.
Yes, yes. It was a really good experience, and I'm so glad I had fulfilling experience with sports, music, and Boy Scouts, and not just being a studious kid who was pushed by his parents to really work hard and make the best out of school.
Sounds like you were well-balanced.
Well, I didn't know that, but I was a nerd in high school, so I don't know if that's really... I would take your compliment.
When you were a child, Libya was pretty recently free from the era of colonial rule by Italy, just in 1951, right?
Yes.
How did the history of colonization affect your family directly or indirectly? And what were some of the family stories that came to you through that era?
It was a very brutal colonization. And unfortunately, it's not very well known. And especially under Italian fascism, where they wanted to conquer Libya and remove the people and take their land. And Libyan society really was unified in many ways and fought for 20 years, including my grandfather, who fought for 15 years. And then when we're defeated, he had to flee them because they want to hang him. So I ended by having a family that when I was growing up, telling me all these horror stories. Libya, Kate, in 1911 had 1 to 1.5 million people. In 1951, it had only 1 million. We think, at least some of us who are studying that period, between at least 500,000 people perished directly and indirectly due to colonization, including people who perished in concentration camps. So the family really were impacted very, very directly. And as a young kid growing up, my grandfather and my mother, who was also lost her mother in exile, kept telling me about these stories and what happened to them. And my grandfather, I believe, he told me his story almost 40 or 50 times. I think he wanted to make sure that I remember it.
He was effective.
Yes, yes, very effective. And ended by becoming, of course, a scholar of North Africa, and especially the topic of colonialism as a result of this brainwashing.
By your grandfather.
Yes.
Yes. Libya is an oil-rich country on the Mediterranean Sea,
yeah,
due south of Italy, and now has a population of around 6 million people.
Yes.
And when you were growing up there, it was more like 1.5.
Yes.
What kinds of things have changed since you lived there as a child?
I was actually lucky because my grandparents and my parents had had to deal with the trauma and also with the displacement and uprooting of colonialism. That didn't even want to educate the kids there. So I was born after independence, and I was lucky because the monarchy that Libya became an independent constitutional monarchy in 1951. It was a modernizing monarchy, a constitutional monarchy, and the UN supported and helped Libya modernize. Libya was one of the poorest countries in the whole world at that time, were with really not much natural resources, even though it's huge. But in 1958, oil was discovered. I think I always say that Mussolini, who led the brutal colonization of Libya, probably is spinning in his grave because he didn't really think of oil or gas.
He was 7 years too late.
Yes. Yeah. So I got lucky, my generation in Libya got lucky because we had schooling that was not available to many people, Libyan people. And I had, schools were built, the government supported hiring teachers from other countries and so. And I was maybe one of the early, the third or the fourth generation that got access to education in Libya, which allowed me to go to high school and after that go to college and get a scholarship. So I feel like I was lucky that time. Education was very, very, very good, I think, in comparison with what is going on right now. And Libyan society, which has a huge, horrible illiteracy rate, that time up to 90%, now has one of the highest literacy rates in the whole of continent of Africa. So things changed quite a bit.
That's really significant.
It is. That's progress, a slow progress, but really societal progress that really impacts ordinary people.
Sounds like that even happened in your family to some extent, where the oral tradition was so rich and the way information was passed along.
Yes.
When they didn't have access to school.
Yes.
And then really embracing education and the infrastructure of the whole country, right?
Yes.
I mean, it sounds like Libya really invests in its people.
Yes.
And I think social services.
Yes. I would say that the monarchy did really well in building and really investing on the education of the younger people, men and women, by the way. And even under the military dictatorship, that continued as well, except that by the 1980s became really not as strong as it used to be. It was a quantity more than the quality that existed before. And it became also geared toward really socializing the youth to support the regime and Gaddafi for a long time. But I have to say, all in all, Libyan society, I think more than the government, have been pushing for that. Mm-hmm. It's not just, we always think of the government that did that.
Actually, it's the people.
It's the people, mm-hmm. exactly, like we have in America. People were really are pushing for education for their kids, and that really led to a tremendous but almost quiet change of Libyan society, where you have men and women are educated, and society is more urban, more literate, more worldly than it used to be during my early childhood.
Looking at the map of Libya, I was struck with geographically how the puzzle pieces almost snap together, the boot of Italy into the top of Libya, just right across the Mediterranean there. And I thought very few countries that were colonized by next door neighbors. You know, they were a boat ride away. Was that more difficult keeping Italy out of Libya when you became independent in 51?
The Libyan people fought very heroically, and that's why they lost a lot, because for one reason, the colonization of Libya was only, it's not like the Tunisian, the French colonization of Tunisia or the British in Egypt. Libya is almost similar to Algeria, which was settler colonization, and that all settler societies are very brutal. And we see that in Africa, we have the Congo, we have Namibia, we have South Africa, we have Libya and Algeria. These are the most brutal experiences of all colonial experiences in Africa. So I think in that sense, we need to realize that not every colonial experience is the same. And Mussolini and the fascists were dreaming of settling over 1 million or 2 million Italian peasants and unemployed, citizen in Libya. So they almost, instead of having land reform in southern Italy, they want to export it to Libya. And fascist, ideology, contrary to our belief that they were lesser evil than Nazi Germany, that's not so true. Actually, I wrote that before, and I'm writing a book about that. They were very brutal. The brutality and the genocide that did not happen in Europe, it happened in Libya. Mm. So I think realizing the trauma and the suffering of others is really one of my scholarly goals since I became an American academic and finished my PhD. Is one of the goals I have tried to do is to write about these horrible experiences and give them justice and give them voices so their voices will not be forgotten and we'll be able to relate to their what they went through earlier and understand their psyche a little bit.
Oh, I want to talk more about your scholarship. That's very interesting to me. If you're just joining us, welcome. Dr. Ali Abdullatif Amida is here in the studio with me today. Dr. Amida was raised in Libya and was educated at the University of Cairo in Egypt. He then came to the United States to study political science at the University of Washington, where he earned his master's degree and PhD. In 1994, he came to Maine to build the political science department at the University of New England from scratch. He is esteemed by colleagues for his scholarship and has frequently been recognized by students for excellence in teaching and mentoring. Ali, your areas of expertise are political theory, comparative politics, and historical sociology.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how you look at and think about modern Libya's ghosts of colonialism today?
I think it's very important that we look forward, but also not to be naive and to overlook the fact that people are so shaped by their own experiences and their own challenges and their own even tragedies and also crises. I'm not interested in names and dates when I research these events, nor I try to just get lost in a lot of details. What I try to look at is the history of the present, how the past impacts us, directly or indirectly. I think Libyan society, like other societies, they have to deal with the legacies of the past that still impact us today. And among some of them will be the concentration camps, the displacement, the exile, the fear of European colonialism and European foreign powers intervention there, and also the memories of people lost, perished due to starvation, diseases, or being starved in concentration camps. All of these fueled Libyans' anxieties and also put them face to face with modern society. And I could give you three examples. Right now, people are looking at the uprising against the Gaddafi's dictatorship. And somebody who always looked at these things, and I have studied them for a long time, I could see that even the symbols of the anti-colonial resistance was raised and taken from the government. So the heroes of resistance, the father of the country, his name is Omar al-Mukhtar, became not only the symbol of Gaddafi's regime, it became the symbol of people uprising. The flag of independence was revised again as a symbol of not the monarchy, but of the whole society. And even the national anthem, they changed it to fit the new uprising. But the whole colonial period, I could see it now in its symbols, the heroes, the leaders, the people who fought for self-determination are being revived again. And I think in a different context, Libyan society, not rural today, is more urban and so, but they are still with us in many ways.
Those are the ghosts.
These are the ghosts, mm-hmm. Yes. And the fears also of the fact that another dictatorship, another power is going to take over us, and we better be prepared this time and be able to take things in our own hands as communities.
Yeah, you commented to me when we met before that when you first came to Seattle, the United States, you couldn't get over how friendly and warm and open people were. And is that a ghost too? Are people living in enough fear in Libya that you don't feel that warmth was surprising to you?
Not really, but I think I'm talking about the region as a whole. I think Libya is a little bit peculiar because Libya was founded by the United Nations and the United States and the UK were really pivotal in helping Libyan people gain their independence. And most of the Libyan educated, bright kids were sent to America. So we have at least four or six generations of Libyan professionals who were educated in America. Almost there is the idealistic, the overly romantic idea about the United States. I think that's so true. But at the same time, what you have is people sometimes, they right now with all the uprising and the dictatorship that happened, there are new radicalization, new extremism that try to perpetuate us vis-a-vis them. And I shared with you the idea of mutual ignorance.
Yes.
Where I feel like always there is a problem when people see black everybody as really in search of enemies or in seeing the other as Islam, as a violent, very, very pre-modern or anti-modern religion. and Muslims are really are not refusing to enter modernity, or the idea that we in America is really as a superpower that try to look down at their religion and look down at them. Both, I think, they are flawed ways, and the idea not to recognize the other and listen to each other is really a big problem. And you see, that's why I call it the mutual ignorance sometimes. And you cannot have bridge or have a conversation without overcoming that block.
This is why you advocate empathy as a remedy for healing.
Yes, yes. I think empathy in the English language is very important because it allows us to be sharing the capacity to share somebody's feeling. It's not just having interest with somebody. I want to listen to you, and I want to also understand how you feel. I want to have a capacity to understand your own feeling as it's mine. See the humanity of the other, even yeah. our enemies. And I think that's very, very important, but quite often because we are fed the idea of clash of civilizations, the clash of cultures, the clash of religions. We sometimes don't investigate whether these assumptions are true or not. And we were led time and again, directly or indirectly, to see us as different.
Mm-hmm.
But I always tell my students, and at UNE, we have a terrific College of Arts and Science. And in my classes, I try to ask the students to investigate what's common, what's similar, and why.
What do we share?
What we share.
Absolutely.
And they surprisingly tell me not so many people told us that they even exist. And I think it's never too late.
Oh, we're big into teams, good and bad.
Yeah.
Us and them.
Yeah, yeah.
Rams versus.
Yes, yes.
You know,
and the other side too. I mean, that's why this is the idea of either the great Satan, mm-hmm. or the infidel idea, as the extremists try to propagate that, or the idea that this is really a violent, problematic religion called Islam, and not diverse experience that include the extremists. The complex one, the humane and the kind, and the modern ones, and vice versa.
Yes.
So the complexity, the diversity, and also the humane faces of Muslims and Arabs, and so sometimes missing. And the extremists also perpetuate the other idea that we are just callous, arrogant society, and wants to just control and pillage and exploit the other.
We're much more diverse than that.
Of course, of course.
So what's the cost of speaking up about people's true stories?
I am really one of the reasons I didn't want to stay in America. I came here for education reasons, and I stayed, as you referred to, in Seattle. And I loved the fact that that city, which is dear to my heart, was very kind to strangers, to newcomers, and very welcoming. I never thought as an outsider, and I got first rate education. So I think I would say, as an American academic, I was fortunate because I have the freedom to express myself, to research any topic, to be secure and have the full rights of citizenship. But in American academia, we have something really valuable, which is the ability to question and research and think critically about any topic. And that's what we try to do at the University of New England, which I chose over two other choices because we liked moving to Maine. And I like the fact that at UNE we have built, many of us faculty and administrators, a very, very stronger university, not only strong on health and science, but also in the liberal arts.
That's something not everybody knows, and you've been crucial in making that happen.
I try to, to do my best in building the program, but also there are terrific colleagues, and I have a wonderful, strong colleagues in my program as well that I recruited myself, and it's one of my one of the things that I'm very proud of. Beside the fact that we like Maine, despite its long, challenging winters.
Well, modern Libya lost you. You're one of their top scholars, a prolific writer, and Thus, you live here with your wife and children in Saco.
Yes.
You said earlier that you have resigned yourself to being bicultural.
Yes.
And as you have lived here longer than you've lived in Libya at this point.
Yes.
I wonder if you might just say just a few words about what it's like for you bridging the two worlds and raising bicultural children. And
well, I think not in, as an academic and a scholar, but also in more of existentialist, more of as a person. A long time ago, since I left Libya after high school and was educated and lived in the United States, I realized that, you know, Libya was part of me and continue to be part of me, an Arab and Muslim culture part of me. But also, I lived most of my life here. I chose to be here. I had other options, but I chose to be here. And actually, I find that very intriguing that I'm now bicultural. I try to find that as an asset, not as something that pulls you apart. And I try to find the commonalities and how these two cultures complement each other. In other words, I look at myself by these two cultures and me as a sort of a strength, not as sort of pulling me to two different directions, opposite directions. And my kids were born in Maine, and we lived here. We are not really newcomers. We actually have been here for 20 years, Kate.
Relatively new meters.
Yes, and hopefully we'll be not far away. We are from away, but we have roots in Maine, and I think my kids were born here. And we loved, one of the reasons we loved about Maine is we wanted small, friendly, decent community. And having both kids being born in Maine and raised in Maine and schooled in Maine was really the right choice for us. We loved it. And they are Mainers in many ways. And I even make jokes about something that when I teach them some Arabic, they pronounce it with Maine accent.
Oh, yeah, I've loved this opportunity to get to know you. You are open, bright, and very insightful. It's an honor for me to have you here today. Thank you for being willing to come on New Mainer Speak.
Kate, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me. This is a wonderful conversation, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
I'm Kate Manahan in the studio with my guest, Ali Abdul-Latif Amida. You have been listening to New Mainer Speak. We will close today's program with some music that Ali has chosen for us. Can you tell us a little bit about your choice here?
This is a favorite song by Sting. It's called Desert Rose. And it was a duetto with a very famous North African singer. His name is Shab Mami. And I think many, many of the listeners, Kate, will identify with Sting. He's a big, big name, of course.
So here you are, the ultimate hybrider of culture. And here we are listening to Sting, who's hybrided his music with Desert Rose.
Yes. Mm-hmm.